The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and this week we're featuring three interviews on the sometimes surprising interactions between science and specific communities. I'm joined now by biologist Daniel N. Lee, a blogger with scientificamerican.com. Daniel uses social media, informal science experiences, and draws from hip-hop culture to share science with general audiences, particularly underserved groups. She writes about the importance of STEM and diversity within the fields of science and calls for better science and science-related news coverage for and about minority audiences. Very wonderful to have you here, Danielle.
Thank you so much.
So in a recent Scientific American post, you wrote, "As we all sit around the table trying to suture the wound of nixing science journalism from many newspapers, magazines, and websites, I am desperately thinking of how science journalism can be implanted in ethnic journalism in the first place." So there are a whole lot of ideas in that sentence. Can you break that down for us?
So I was recently at a catalysis meeting, which is a meeting of scientists and journalists and those of us who kind of blur the lines to science educators or outreach scientists at NESCENT, which is the National Evolutionary Science Center. So it's a think tank, essentially, that does a lot of work, research as well as these kind of meetings, these little conclaves to discuss topical issues related to science and science policy and, in particular, evolution. And it was a group of scientists and journalists who were interested in the narrative of science and how do we get good science information out to the public to make sure it's accurate. Because for the most part, evolutionary science has been under attack and there's a lot of school districts trying to change it or to do the teach the controversy thing. And, you know, and I agree with all of that. But as a person, as an African-American woman who I read both what's considered mainstream news and I read, you know, the weekly black newspapers and those news zines that are also targeted to African-Americans, I noticed that in my entire history of reading, you know, Ebony magazine and Essence magazine from my grandmother's coffee table, there has never been a science section in those magazines.
Let's start out by defining what is ethnic journalism?
And maybe I don't know because I'm not a journalist. I mean, and it's part of what it is. I'm speaking as a consumer.
Right.
It is journalism that is targeted for certain audiences. So, you know, in some markets where there's a immigrant population, you have some of those, you know, papers that come in native languages. So those seem obvious, you know. So if you have a huge Bosnian community, you have a Bosnian newspaper or, you know, the Little Italy flyer. Well, in a lot of major cities, particularly during the time of the Great Migration in the 1900s, a lot of the major cities along the Black migration route had these amazing black-owned newspapers. And so, and I grew up reading these papers. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and the Tri-State Defender, which still exists, yay, is one of those weekly papers where African-Americans were able to get, you know, news that was relevant to the African-American community, in addition to, you know, what came out in the daily morning and evening papers. These were issues, particularly when the Civil Rights Movement was very popular, they reported that information, you know, trying to get civil rights. And so now, post-civil rights movement, these papers, some of them didn't survive, but they still provide news that is targeted for the interests of, you know, those minority groups. So there are Native American news press out there, because I know on Twitter I follow Native American news. And I live in Oklahoma now, and there's like these little mini segments that come on NPR that's the Native American news. And they talk about news that's relevant to Native Americans. So I imagine that what's universal about it is it's talking about those issues and topics that are relevant to, you know, that particular ethnic group.
But not science.
But not science. And let me be clear, I have a very selective ear and eye. I'm focusing on African-American issues. But when I've had a couple of casual conversation with Latino friends, you know, one of my Latino friends was like, well, now that you mention it, it's not very obvious to me, but they hadn't thought about it. But it's still an issue in how well, you know, those of us who happen to be scientists of color, how much we see our profession, you know, represented in what in our mainstream. So within our, you know, within our bubble, how science isn't always well represented.
How is it represented, would you say?
That positive experiences with science is rare. So first of all, you don't get much science news to begin with. When it does happen, it's usually the Black History Month segments where, oh my goodness, it's, you know, the great pioneer or the prodigy, you know, the kid genius, or the against all odds, you know, the mom with, you know, single mom with 9 kids who persevered through all odds, or what I call the disparity narrative or the disempowerment narrative. It's a lot of that out there where it reports news that it's where regrettably our statistics are always the unfortunate ones. Like, you know, we're the ones always dying of diabetes and not getting well, or it's a repeat of another misfortune in science ethics. So it's always these disempowerment or disparity narratives, which overall shapes this notion that a positive experience with science is rare. It's not the norm. So we don't get a lot of everyday stories of what's happening with scientists and engineers of color.
So why do you think that is?
Because there is this notion, and I've heard people say it anecdotally, but and I have too many friends that have heard it too. Oh, science is boring. This notion that science is boring, or it's not interesting, or it's too many big words. So it's the same thing you hear from mainstream press, of course. But I feel like it takes on something extra because we're already so underrepresented and underserved.
So now how would you say, because we said during the bio that you're calling for more coverage for and about minority mm-hmm. audiences. So what would that look like?
For me, that would look like, so because I believe in dreaming big. That would mean every major Black newspaper would have a science section. That would mean all the major Black websites and magazines that go with them, the Ebony, Essence, the Roots, and the Griots of the world, would have a dedicated science and health section. They would have that too. At their minimum, there would be a science desk that would magically appear at all of these media outlets.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Daniel N. Lee, a blogger with ScientificAmerican.com. We're talking about minority audiences and science-related news coverage. Okay, so we mentioned the words, you know, speculation and bias and such. So then this is one of the problems. When we're talking about this area, people want proof. Proof that there are issues and proof that if the issues do exist, then it's appropriate for us to be taking them on in any kind of formal way. Is that your experience?
Yeah, it is. That's all I can say.
And so this is what I want to talk about. Now, before the show, you and I were sort of corresponding by email, and I asked you for research in this area. Tell us about that.
I do not at all know of any research that examines anything related to the question of science reporting to diverse, ethnically diverse audiences. I can't find it. When you do find some things about it, the diversity is defined as diversity of science readers, such as policymakers or teachers and students. It does not define it as ethnically diverse or even different population demographics.
But that's so interesting to me because this, you know, diversity is a bit of a buzzword within not just science, but within a number of communities.
I know that Unity, UNITY, I feel like Queen Latifah, UNITY, but it is a media professional convention of most of the special audience journalists. So it's the Native American Journalists Association, Latino journalists, LGBT journalists. At one point, the National Association of Black Journalists were officially a part of it. They're not officially a part of it anymore, but they are one of the, you know, they still participate in ways. Mm-hmm. Asian American. And I had a conversation, interestingly, with not the program officer, but someone who's a decision maker at AAAS, so the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And they have a couple of special internships and fellowships just about this very topic, minority journalism. They have a minority journalist internship for journalist students of color to get them trained in science journalism. And when and how the program came about, she said, was because when they were trying to get more students for science internships, they were having a hard time getting minority students to apply. And they still sometimes have a challenge doing that. And so I've actually talked to them because they were like, when you figure this question out, let us know. This is something we care about as well. Somebody has the numbers. Who, I don't know. I know the numbers exist. So there's a way to figure out exactly how many of these minority student journalist interns over the years have actually now gotten jobs in, you know, science magazines or science sections. I know this much. If they're minority journalists who did a science internship, they're not working at a black paper because there's no science section for them to work in.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Now, do you think these communities that we consider underserved in this area, is there any call for it coming from those communities? Any call for science reporting?
No. So that is
the other problem.
I'm deliberately speaking gingerly because right. I am attempting to make friends with that community. I don't know what they're saying about me, but I'm sure a couple of side eyes have been put in my direction on Twitter. Because about a month or two ago, I did get into a little bit of a Twitter spat with whoever the web person is behind the Twitter account of Ebony Magazine.
Do tell.
So me and my insomnia at 5 a.m. read a tweet that said, forced sterilizations of Ethiopian Jewish women. Oh. And I read the article, and what it was they were forced to have Depo-Provera shots before they could enter Israel. And I was like, your headline's incorrect. Depo-Provera isn't sterilization.
Right.
You know, Depo is birth control. Your ability to reproduce does come back. Was it bad that it was forced? Absolutely. And the paper went into, you know, it mentions the Tuskegee experiment. It mentions, you know, the forced sterilizations in North Carolina. So it touched on those painful parts that I call the hallmarks of the disparity of the disempowerment narrative. And as a community, we revisit those painful parts all the time without the balance of how the ethics and science have changed. It is still far from perfect. But it's not exactly the same as it was when the Tuskegee experiment was going on. It wasn't the same system as when the Gila, the sad thing that happened to Henrietta Lacks happened. So it's not the exact same system. And I want people to participate in it because our failure to participate means we don't have enough folks watching to keep those types of things happening again. And so basically I was rattling off tweets. I mean, I was firing them off, me and my thumbs on my phone. And by 8 a.m, they were like, geez, we got your tweets. They changed the headline, which, according to all my science friends, like, that's a big deal. You got a headline change. But in the conversation, the person asked me, you know, like, what do you mean about this whole we don't cover science stuff? You know, and I was like, well, you don't have a science section and the science is incorrect. And, you know, if you had a science editor or at least somebody in your Rolodex, you know, they could have caught that, you know, and they were like, well, you've never pitched us a science story. And I'm like, you're right. I haven't. I'm not a journalist. I didn't make this ruckus to then compel you to give me a job.
Right.
But I thought it was very telling that their response was, nobody in our office has ever received a science pitch. So they admitted that. I'm not sure if that's exactly true, because if you've ever gotten a health and wellness pitch, that's science.
Right.
And so that told me a few things. One, we've compartmentalized science so much that we don't even see it when it's available to us. We don't see opportunities to just kind of just do a little bit right there. It also said something about the editorial process of that magazine. They are waiting for folks to pitch them ideas. And so no one had put that on their mind, so it never crossed their mind. And that caused me to start thinking and asking the two or three journalists that I know, particularly those who work in that market, that ethnic media market. And if you didn't go to like one of the bigger journalism schools, you probably did not have a class in science journalism. So I'm a scientist, so I tend to think in science. So if I wasn't busy doing my own research, which has nothing to do with science journalism. I would like to know how many of, at least of the HBCUs that have communications and journalism majors, do they offer science journalism?
Well, actually, and that brings me to another question, is if there isn't a lot of research in this area and people continually want proof, either just to see that there's a problem at all, but it, additionally for funding for these kind of projects
For me, my question is, who does this? Would journalists do this?
I don't know. And I'm going to open this up to the audience because I find this topic fascinating. It's something that a lot of people are very interested in. So, A, if you know of any research that's done in this area, if you are a researcher that is doing research in this area, glorious. If you have any opinions on this, please do go to skepticallyspeaking.com and comment in the comment section of this show. I would love to have this conversation, and hopefully, Danielle, you will be willing to be a part of that.
I would love to. This much I know. For whatever reason, science is completely off the radar of Black journalists. It just does not seem to be a part of the conversation among Black professional journalists and in those ethnic media outlets. Science just, they're not anti-science. I want to be very, very clear about that. It just doesn't seem to come up. I think it's been so compartmentalized as special, such a special thing, that nobody touches it until they have to. So I submitted some presentation proposals for the National Association of Black Journalism. Mm-hmm. So that association, which is at least 20, 30 years old, has several what they call task force, which are professional development groups. And they're the things that you think of: broadcast journalism, print journalism, digital, sports, entertainment, celebrity. There's no science task force.
What the hell? Oh.
So I've been given the opportunity to submit a proposal to start a health and science task force.
So what would that do then, this task force?
So the task force creates professional development silos for young journalists and seasoned journalists alike to talk about the craft related to reporting in that sector. And they talk about those issues, those professional development issues that help an individual, you know, gain employment, keep employment, you know, increase their network so that they can get more jobs. And so what I would like to do is to bring the connections I already have in science to journalists. So if the paperwork goes well and if I don't do something weird and step on too many toes, there'll be a workshop this summer at the meeting, the National Association of Black Journalists, where there'll actually be science journalists. And when I put the panel together, the folks who I invited to participate, like the moderator who's an NABJ member, she's a person of color. You may know her. I don't know if you know Jamila Bay.
I do.
So Jamila Bay is one person. But at the time when we were thinking of, like, who can we get to present, there is no African-American science journalist who's a heavy hitter. I finally started discovering minority science journalists, and it's a list of about a dozen people that are on Twitter. And that's the question. So one of my questions to just other Black journalists, can you name a science journalist? It's not to be confrontational. It's a serious question about how we haven't thought about this. Can you name any Black science journalists?
I am so looking forward to seeing what you do with that. And Danielle, thank you so much for being here and bringing this up and for writing about this.
Thank you. No, thank you very much for inviting me. I had a blast.
You can find a link to Danielle N. Lee on scientificamerican.com or at the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with microbiologist Rebecca Creston, author of the blog Body Horrors, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my next guest is Rebecca Creston, a microbiologist, public health researcher, and soon-to-be medical student in New Orleans, Louisiana. She writes at the DiscoverMagazine.com blog Body Horrors on the history, anthropology, and geography of infectious diseases and parasites. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, Desiree. Thank you for having me.
Now, I love your blog for many reasons, but for one in particular, which is the one that you're here to talk about today. You have written a number of posts about infectious diseases that we see in very specific communities. So when did that start?
The reason why I got interested in this is because human culture has been shaped so terrifically by infectious diseases. We are what we are biologically and culturally to some extent because of our relationships with the microorganisms that we have lived with for centuries and evolved alongside, and our behaviors have evolved accordingly. There is a whole wild spectrum of human culture, of religion, of societal practices that are side effects of our biologies and the histories of our previous infections. Some examples include religious dietary laws, such as kashrut and halal, for instance. And these are clearly related to disease and a form of public health. And so I guess my interest in how certain social groups are disproportionately affected by disease is really a question of, well, how much of what makes us on a cultural or a sociological level can be traced to microbiology and disease and human health?
Well, and sometimes you cover illnesses that emerge specifically in cultural communities or perhaps religious communities, like you said. Is that difficult to cover? Because you're definitely going to get into sensitive territory there.
Oh, I think it's one of the most sensitive territories you could venture into. So, yeah, I try and write as delicately as possible. I try to go into as much history as possible and explain some of the origins and ideas behind some religious practices in different communities. But there are some communities that they partake in certain behaviors that do put them at risk for disease. And often those behaviors are sanctioned or socially and culturally acceptable by that group's cultural norms, or they live in an environment that encourages that sort of behavior.
So how do you navigate that?
Well, I put a lot of time and research into my work, and I try and make sure to have as many people read my work before I publish it, just to make sure that I'm not saying anything inflammatory by accident. I try to be as sensitive as possible because, as we mentioned, this can be a very sensitive topic.
So what's the reception been like to those posts, I guess, specifically?
They've been well received. I haven't received any negative commentary yet.
No, I noticed that on the internet.
I know, great. On the internet, no less. Yeah, I mean, they've been well received, but, we've got time.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the posts.
Sure.
Starting with the Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca, known as the Hajj.
Yeah, the Hajj is an annual pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. And it must be completed by Muslims at least once in their lifetime. And it's basically a series of performative rites in the city of Mecca and its environs. And at the completion of their religious rites, Hajis migrate to Mina, where there are hundreds of barbers awaiting with razor blades. And they shave the scalps of male pilgrims. And this kind of last ritual seals the deal and allows pilgrims to complete their observance of the Hajj. But unfortunately, a lot of these barbers are unlicensed. They can be found reusing unsterilized blades to communally head shave Hajis. They toss and dispose of the razors improperly, and they don't wear gloves. And so these series of behaviors involving razor blades can result in the transmission of bloodborne diseases.
Well, how big of an issue is this at the Hajj? Like, how many cases of bloodborne illnesses do we see?
The research is pretty sparse on this. There's just millions of people who make this pilgrimage. Some of these barbers are unlicensed, and so what they're doing is essentially illegal. So it's hard to track them down. But it's basically a numbers game. When you're having millions of people in a small, dusty town in Saudi Arabia, it can be hard to figure out just what exactly is going on.
And you do say in your post that it's really the potential that's the issue for a micro-epidemic.
Absolutely. There is the potential for it. That doesn't necessarily mean that it does happen. But what I'm saying in that article is that this is a public health need to remove these barbers, or maybe not remove them, but to have them be educated on the risks of disease transmission, as well as to educate the millions of people who go and attend the Hajj.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Rebecca Creston, microbiologist and public health researcher. So tell us about a day in the life of the Turkana tribe.
The Turkana tribe are nomadic pastoralists living in northwest Kenya. They're in an arid parcel of land that's bound by Uganda, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. And a day in the life of a Turkana tribesman is quite interesting. They have a very unique relationship with the yellow pariah dogs that are in their community. Because of the very unique environment that they live in, an area that is nearly bereft of water, they rely on dogs as, let's see, they rely on them as nursemaids to children who have yet to be toilet trained. They lick cookingware and servingware clean, and they herd their cattle and their goats, their camels. And there is this parasitic disease, it's known as Echinococcus granulosis, that is endemic in that region. It's a type of tapeworm. It has a life cycle that relies on a carnivore, livestock carnivore pattern, where it cycles through an intermediate host, like a goat or a camel or a donkey. And when that intermediate host dies, the carnivore, such as a dog or a wolf, will eat the entrails and infected viscera that contain the parasite. And then those carnivores will become infected with thousands of tiny tapeworms and shed those tapeworm eggs in their feces. The sheep or the livestock or what have you will consume those eggs, and the cycle continues, the circle of life.
And tell me about this parasite, because it's awful.
It's really awful. Yeah, I wouldn't Google image it. This parasite, it travels to a number of organs, to the liver, the lungs, the brain, and they form these kind of bubbly cysts. And there can just be dozens to hundreds of these cysts. And it can be a quite traumatic disease for some people, though the rates of serious infection are quite low.
So because of this close relationship between the Turkana and the dogs...
The Turkana are infected with the parasite, yes.
And so if they wanted to avoid this parasite, basically they would have to change practically everything about their day-to-day lives. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. You know, their environment and their geography inform a lot of their behaviors and their culture. So we have this really arid climate. There's a lack of water. Their occupation as pastoralists, all of these factors inform their need for these dogs. And the many benefits, so to speak, that these dogs can offer to this tribe is needed in this very poor community. And most of it is tied to the need to spare them the use of precious water.
So on to pig tapeworms. Yay.
Yeah.
So tell us about them.
One of the really interesting and kind of neat things about pig tapeworms, is that there are some people who can have the tapeworm infection in their intestinal tract. And then there's some people who will accidentally ingest the eggs from the pig tapeworm. And those eggs, instead of going into a pig, they go into a human and they can travel to the brain and form neurocysticercosis. And so there is this kind of very tragic situation where for people who are vegetarians or for people who abstain from pork products, they can still acquire neurocysticercosis even if they don't consume pork products.
How does that happen?
There's a very well-known case of an Orthodox Jewish community in New York City in the early 90s. A number of individuals of the Orthodox Jewish faith appeared in local New York City hospitals with recurrent seizures, and radiology showed evidence of brain lesions that were identified as the larval form of the pig tapeworm, and they had formed these kind of protective cysts that were encased within the brain. And an epidemiological investigation found that many of the families of these patients had employed housemaids, who were all recent immigrants from Latin and Central America, and it just so happened that they were infected with the adult tapeworm infection and had inadvertently transmitted the infective eggs to their employers.
Why was it so prevalent in the housekeepers then?
In Latin and Central America, or at least some countries in Latin and Central America, there are some exemplary levels of pork consumption and endemic pig tapeworm infection. It's just a very common infection. And neurocysticercosis is very common in Central America and Latin America. It's known as one of the neglected tropical diseases. You know, this is a really interesting story because you're talking about globalization, you're talking about class, you're talking about it has some very interesting socioeconomic implications. It's talking about immigrants leaving the developed world or leaving developing countries and going to the developed world to provide for their families. And this was the case. These women traveled to the city and took care of these families. And many of those women were charged with childcare responsibilities. And it just so happened that through, inadequate hygiene that they had transferred the infection over.
So how could that have been avoided then?
People just need to follow basic public health precautions. That involves hand washing. That involves cooking food properly so you're not eating raw or inadequately cooked pork, because that's where this the pig tapeworm infection comes from, or at least the adult form. You know, a lot of these parasitic diseases, the Turkana tribe, for example, and the story of the Orthodox Jewish community, a lot of it can be tied, sadly, to poor sanitation or inadequate sewerage infrastructure. And that's why we don't really see a lot of diseases like this in the United States, because we have infrastructure where we can separate, you know, say our toilet water from our drinking water. We have sinks, we have hand washing detergents, we have soap, you know. So a lot of these diseases, these neglected tropical diseases, take place in areas that are greatly in need of that kind of infrastructure and those kinds of public health preventative tools.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by microbiologist and public health researcher and soon-to-be medical student Rebecca Creston. Since we're already talking about meat, let's talk about meat handlers. This is an interesting one. Not that all of them aren't, but this is as you point out in your post, there are occupational hazards in every profession. But there is an interesting and rather unexpected one for the people that slaughter animals for our food.
Right. So people who are, say, butchers or fishmongers, I think it's about 23% of people who handle meat and fish and poultry will develop warts on their hands. There's a certain type of virus, human papillomavirus number 7. We know this virus, HPV, is forming other kinds of warts in other kinds of places, but there is a certain type of virus, HPV 7, that can form on the hands of people who work in these kind of strenuous environmental conditions that are unique to these occupations, namely cold temperatures, water, warm animal blood, and incurring microscopic cuts and scrapes from handling those animals and from handling blades used to cut their flesh.
Okay, so let's clarify. No one really knows what it is puts these workers at additional risk.
For the most part, we don't know, which I know is a really unsatisfactory answer. But researchers believe that HPV-7 is distributed throughout the human population. It's on your hands, it's on my hands, it's on my husband's hands, it's on anyone's hands. But it only emerges under certain environmental conditions or stimuli. And some people believe that there is some component of animal flesh that predisposes that activation of the HPV-7 virus in your skin. And some people believe that animal meat or animal blood has some sort of immunosuppressive factors that allow for HPV-7 to blossom. And one study that seems to support this idea is that there are lower incidences of warts on people who work in modern slaughterhouses that use automated butchering rather than butchering by hand.
Oh, good. So, but ultimately, no idea.
No idea, right? Awesome. I know, and that's so unsatisfactory, but that's kind of the reality with infectious disease research and with parasites, especially with parasites, because you can't really study parasites in a lab because they have such a complicated life cycle. So that's one of the enjoyable things about my writing, is that I can just talk about the macrobiology of the microbiology. I don't have to wonder why this immunosuppressive factor has anything to do with this, or about the immunology of this, or the cellular biology of this. It's much more interesting to speculate on human behavior and human culture.
Indeed. On to herpes. Herpes gladiatorum, to be precise. So what is that?
There are a number of professional athletes and not so professional athletes in what some people call gladiatorial combat style sports. And that would include sumo wrestling, rugby, American or Australian style football. And what all those sports have in common is that there's a lot of body bashing and face-to-face smearing. And unfortunately, these athletes are at an enhanced risk of skin infections and soft tissue infections, largely because of the very intimate contact that they have with each other. And actually, it's not just herpes. It can be methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, otherwise known as MRSA in the media. It can be ringworm, or otherwise known as tinea corporis. There's a whole plethora of skin and soft tissue infections that can be transmitted by people that engage in these sports.
I do just want to point out that it is also known in some circles as scrumpox, which tickles me, and I do not know why.
Yeah, I think any term that includes the word pox is a good one. It's a pretty old school term.
So what can be done about this? Because like some of the other ones that we're talking about, it would really require a complete overhaul of the system people are currently using, whether that be using dogs as sort of helpmates or, you know, smushing your face into each other.
There's a lot of very easy public health precautions you can take with professional athletes. Don't share towels, don't share water bottles or clothing or equipment and hygiene and cosmetic products. Don't share razors. If there is someone with a herpes lesion or some sort of weird festering skin infection, they can't play. Or if they do, they need to have those lesions completely covered up. That is something that you can really tackle quite easily in the public health world and among schools that have athletic teams and in our professional athlete organizations. That's something that's very easily taken care of.
Okay, so one last community, the marijuana smoking community, and I'm going to consider that a community for the purposes of this conversation because I really like this post. There was a salmonella outbreak?
There was a salmonella outbreak in 1981. It was a multi-state outbreak. It was in Ohio, Michigan, Georgia, and Alabama. And at the time, these CDC investigators were unable to find the source of the outbreak. They were unable to find the edible source of the outbreak. However, 70% of those who were infected reported using marijuana. And investigators discovered that this marijuana had been imported from either Colombia or Jamaica. And they believe that the harvesters or farmers had deliberately adulterated the product with manure to increase its weight and raise its consumer costs. And people got ill from handling the marijuana. They either, you know, touched their mouth or contaminated their food, or they contaminated their family members inadvertently.
How did the CDC track that?
I think it was just one of those serendipitous discoveries. The thing about foodborne disease outbreaks is that they're actually really, really hard to track down. You know, it's one thing to find the bug in the food. It's quite another to figure out, well, what farm is this from? Where did this particular bug come from? And I think this was just a very serendipitous wonderful discovery.
I love these posts, Rebecca. So what else do you have in mind? Is there anything that you've been wanting to cover, but maybe you just haven't gotten around to doing it yet?
There's a post that I have in the works about the hip-hop community and HIV mythology. A lot of hip-hop artists and rappers will talk about the origins of HIV and how it's tied to a government plot to infect people. And I really want to address that issue in an article at some point, because I think it's a very dangerous misconception to be spreading through the community. Because at this moment, the community that's most affected by HIV in the United States right now is the African American community. And so that's an article I have in the works. There's some news coming out from Europe in which people who use heroin and inject heroin have been infected with anthrax. There's been a few cases of botulism outbreaks among prisoners who brew Pruno, which is a kind of counterfeit booze made out of, actually, I don't even know what they make it out of, but there have been a few botulism outbreaks from it. I have a whole bunch of stuff up my sleeve, and that's what I'm going to be doing this summer, is writing about all this really fun stuff.
I'm very much looking forward to reading all of this. Rebecca, you're lovely. Thanks for
Thank
being
you.
Here.
Of course. Thank you so much, Desiree.
You can find Rebecca Creston and her brilliant blog, Body Horrors, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be back with an interview with Dr. Joseph Henrich on Americans as Outliers after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at science and critical thinking, Canadian style. York University science librarian John Dupuy joins us to discuss what he calls the Canadian government's war on science. And Chris McDonald, director of the Jim Pattison Ethical Leadership Program at Ryerson University, joins us to talk about his textbook, The Power of Critical Thinking. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
My last guest today is Dr. Joseph Henrich, who holds the Canada Research Chair in Culture, Cognition, and Coevolution at the University of British Columbia, where he's a professor in both economics and psychology. His theoretical work focuses on how natural selection has shaped human learning and how this in turn influences cultural evolution and culture gene coevolution. Welcome, Joseph.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
So let's go all the way back to 1995 in Peru. Now, walk me through why you were there.
Well, at the time, I was in graduate school in anthropology, and I was beginning to do my master's research. And so I, you know, headed off like a young graduate student, off and took a missionary plane and landed on a river called the Urubamba in the southeast Peruvian Amazon and began to study economic behavior there.
So tell me about why you were there in the first place.
Sure. Well, at that point, I had a real interest in what I think of as applied questions. So I was trying to use what we knew about how people make decisions and what things affect behavior to think about how increasing degrees of market integration might be affecting people's decision making and specifically their willingness to cut down the forest. As part of that project, I brought with me some experiments which economists had been conducting on undergraduates in the U.S. and Europe in an effort to get a sense of people's pro-sociality towards other members of their community.
So why did you decide to run behavioral experiments instead of the fairly standard anthropological experiments?
Within anthropology, the emphasis is really on qualitative field work. So you go to a population, you live with them for an extended period of time, learn the language, learn the local customs. But there's no emphasis, or at least not much anyway, on really measuring stuff, on using the kinds of tools that cognitivists and social psychologists use or that behavioral economists use. So I was trying to introduce those techniques because I thought I could, and I still think this, that you can really get a lot out of combining those two methods of being on the ground and understanding how people live their lives, but then making a real effort to try to quantify things and take advantage of the full range of tools that the social science has to offer. The experiment I use is actually called the ultimatum game, and it's the second most well-known experiment behind the prisoner's dilemma. So in the ultimatum game, two anonymous players, so two people who don't know each other and have no reason to expect that they're going to interact again, have to divide up a sum of money. And the job of the first player is to offer a portion of the money. So say it's $100 and the first player decides to offer 10 out of the $100. The second player is faced with a choice to accept or reject. If they accept the offer, they get the $10 and the other player gets the remainder, or they can reject, in which place both players get zero. And so the nice thing about this experimental tool is that if people are purely self-interested and everybody knows that and agrees on it, then you should expect the first player to make a very low offer, so say $10 out of the 100. And the second player is faced with a choice. If he accepts, he gets $10 and the other guy gets 90. Or if he rejects, he gets zero. So given a choice between zero or 10, he should always pick 10, preferring more money to less money. The interesting thing is that you don't find that anywhere. Although among the Machigenga, people were unwilling to reject, although the mean offer was still around 25%. There were lots of offers of about 15% of the total. And this was a real contrast to what had previously been found in student experiments, where people gave half the amount of money, and rejections below 40% or 30% of the total pot were frequently rejected, such that it would be unwise to do that because you're so likely to get rejected.
And what was your interpretation of that?
At first, I was a bit surprised because if I had had to place bets before I ran this experiment, I would have thought that people would have behaved, or the Matsu Genga would have behaved in a way very similar to how undergraduates did. But as I lived there longer and got to understand how social life worked, I came to realize that, you know, people don't really have social norms for dealing with anonymous others. Everything that goes on in the community is governed by rules about taking care of kinship or dealing with people from other ethno-linguistic groups, or even trading with traders who they know and will see again. But this put them in a situation where the only thing they knew, there was another person in the same situation. So what do you do there? And I began to develop the idea that to make modern societies run, to make market economies run, you actually needed some pretty serious social norms in order to get people to engage in these transactions, these mutually beneficial, equitable transactions.
Okay, so but you didn't stop there. You've actually done this research on other small-scale societies as well. So what did you find there?
Right. So we've actually done two different rounds of experiments across 15 quite diverse societies. So we went to remote parts of New Guinea and to hunter-gatherers in Africa and all around the world. And what we find in each case, in both experiments, you know, replicated the second time with more experiments, is that the populations that are more integrated in markets make higher offers in this game and are more willing to reject. So the larger society, the more willing people are to reject in the ultimatum game and another similar experiment. And we also found that societies who have a religion with a high moralizing God, so Christianity and Islam, make more offers independent of things like income and wealth and market integration and community size. So those seem to be the two factors that explain the higher offers we found in some societies.
Now, doesn't this basically fly in the face of all the previous research that's been done in this area?
There's actually been really no comparable experimental type research. There is this general notion you would get from reading ethnographies of hunter-gatherers, other small-scale societies, that people are very pro-social. And I don't think it's inconsistent with that. I mean, my own ethnography would report the same thing. But these are based on social norms about how you treat with kin or how you deal with other members of your village, as opposed to social norms that say how you're supposed to deal with someone who you don't know and won't see again, an anonymous stranger. And as far as experimental work, psychologists and behavioral economists typically only work with student subjects.
Right.
So there was no comparable amount of work to compare it with.
How did anthropologists respond?
I think in two separate ways. One, I think a constructive way, is that a small fraction of cultural anthropologists and biological anthropologists began to more seriously adopt some of the methods that I presented and began to take the idea that we could think about cultural evolution and use very systematic methods across diverse societies. Although I still think it's true that the sort of center of the field had a very negative reaction and finds the idea of trying to quantify human behavior as politically aversive.
Well, I read that some of those individuals thought that your research was unethical. And maybe I'm missing something, but why would that be?
Well, the idea is you're bringing in outside influences and you're making them make decisions about that'll affect other members of their community. And that somehow that turns into a corrupting influence. Now, of course, if you talk to the people themselves, you know, they fully understand what's going on. They are looking to play the games again. They see it as a very positive experience. And I think ethnographers all around the world who've tried this have had the same experience. But, I mean, there is this kind of concern, and a lot of it's appropriate. There's been so much exploitation of indigenous populations. But in this particular case, it's actually contributing to the community in a very clear and substantial way.
I have to ask, might this not lead us to wonder if we were wrong about this, might we also be wrong about maybe other assumptions about human nature?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of what happened to me. So as I was thinking about all this stuff around 2006, I arrived at UBC and I met two colleagues, Arnor and Zion and Steve Heine, who are cultural psychologists. And I was, you know, noticing that Westerners seemed to be the outlier in all the experiments we'd done at the far end of the distribution. And my two colleagues had noticed that in their own quite very different lines of work. So we began to do a review of it, and it seems that there's a whole set of important psychological, behavioral, motivational measures that psychologists have done. And whenever they've been done in across diverse human societies, which is relatively rare, but there was enough that we could collect a bunch of these examples. Westerners are frequently at the far end of the distribution. They seem to be unusual compared to the rest of the world.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to Joseph Henrich about how all those human behaviors we've thought of as being universal might not be. So maybe tell us about your co-collaborators' work, because they're also doing terribly interesting things.
My one collaborator, Arnon Zion, he works on reasoning. He's done experiments in the Middle East and in East Asia, as well as with American undergraduates, to show that people's styles of reasoning, whether they take an analytical approach where they categorize things and sort things by category, see straight line relationships, as opposed to holistic reasoning, where people are looking at the full context, expecting nonlinear relationships, and categorizing in a kind of gestalt manner that takes lots of variables into account. That these two approaches, which come right down, which can also be seen in basic perceptual judgments, are very different in these different populations. At first, he thought it was just an East-West difference, comparing Americans to East Asians. But then, as he went to the Middle East, and I actually ran some experiments of the same kind in South America, what we found was that, there was the West and the rest. Everybody else seemed to be reasoning pretty similarly in these tasks, and the Westerners seemed to be the outliers, and particularly the Americans.
Well, maybe can we talk about some of those individual tests? Because I think the differences in perception are very interesting. Maybe the Mueller-Lyon illusion.
Right. Well, so that's a perceptual illusion. It's very famous, so you'll encounter it in any kind of introductory textbooks. And it's the one that has two lines which are parallel to each other, and one of the line has arrowheads at each end, and the other has arrow tails at each end. And the typical thing that you'll find repeatedly, and it's often pitched as a reliably developing feature of the human visual system, is that people see the line with the arrowheads on it as shorter than the line with the tails on it. It's an illusion that's created by the way the tails create a kind of three-dimensional, it makes you think you're looking into the paper a little bit. But when this has been done in diverse societies, we find that hunter-gatherers, for example, in the Kalahari Desert, don't see the illusion. Presumably, they would just call it the Mueller-Lyon drawing, because they see the lines as they actually are. They can tell when they're the same length and different lengths. Whereas when you do experiments, say, in Chicago, where the experiments were done, the shorter line has to be 20% longer than the other line before people see them as the same length.
So what can these differences be attributed to then?
Well, in the case of the Mueller-Lyon illusion, the leading hypothesis is just that it's the visual environment. So if you grow up in most environments that humans have lived in throughout our evolutionary history, there's not a lot of 90-degree angles. But if you grow up in a city, you see lots of 90-degree angles. So you're in rooms all the time. And your visual system is actually, it projects on a two-dimensional, on the back of your retina, which is two-dimensional. And then your brain has to turn that into a three-dimensional image. So it learns to make judgments when it sees certain kinds of relationships. So it can turn what would be the corners of a room into a depth, and it makes assumptions that allow you to perceive depth. But if you grow up in a different kind of environment, it doesn't build in the idea that there's 90-degree angles all around you. So you get the Mueller-Lyon illusion. So it turns out to be just a peculiar byproduct of the fact that in our world we have all these 90-degree angles.
Well, but these kind of differences exist across a range of fields in research, according to your paper.
Right. So in the analytic holistic distinction, it has to do with a whole bunch of things. But one of the things is how you categorize things. So holistic reasoners tend to look for relationships between things. And analytic reasoners tend to look for categorizations. So that's a big difference we find. There's differences in the notions of the self and about what's an important part of morality. So in Western subjects, we often find that people are concerned about fairness and harm. Whereas when you study morality in other societies, you find that people are concerned about divinity and purity and hierarchy, which you don't find very much among Western subjects.
So could it be attributed to anything like genetics?
Well, in our paper, we left open, there's all kinds of sources of variation among populations. So I tend to think of a lot of the variation is cultural. So as you grow up in a particular environment, you learn all kinds of things from other members of your social group. You become good at certain kinds of skills. So for example, people vary in how good they are at distinguishing different colors, depending on what kind of color terms are in their language. So in small-scale societies, you'll have some languages that'll just distinguish black and white and not have other colors like red, blue, and green. And that can cut two ways. It can make you better or worse at distinguishing colors depending on where the border between the shades you're talking about, where that fits with your standard color terms. So that's just a case where if you have a language, it causes you to have to do something a lot and makes you either better or worse at distinguishing colors.
Well, I probably should point out the name of the paper. WEIRD. What does that stand for?
Right. So that was an acronym we came up with just to refer to this unusual population because they were Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So that creates the acronym WEIRD, which we used as a label to refer to the typical subjects in psychological experiments. So it turns out 90% of students of people in psychology experiments are weird people, meaning they're Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And this is a particularly strange population to make inferences from to humans because we live in a world that's so much different than the environments that we would have evolved in. So there's all kinds of reasons why you might expect our psychologies to be different because the environment we live in is so different from those ancestral environments.
And as you said, the weird ones are actually the group with the most atypical responses comparatively.
Right. So one thought that could have been the case, for example, is it might have been that undergraduates and weird people are representative of the human species. That's certainly not the case. It might have been that there's lots of cultural variation, but Westerners are just as unusual as everyone else, and so they're just as central. They're not pushing your inferences in any particular direction. But what it turns out is on a whole bunch of dimensions, they're at the far end of the distribution. I mean, the main thrust of our paper is people in the researchers in the experimental sciences need to think much more about their subject pools and about the immense diversity of human variation that's out there. Some of which is cultural, but some of it could be more like the Mueller-Lyer illusion, where it's kind of cultural in the sense that, you know, buildings and carpentered corners are cultural, but then it gets into your mind not through social learning, but from the fact that your visual system is trying to adapt to the world around it. There could be epigenetic differences that have to do with the kinds of foods people eat or the kinds of environmental stresses they're exposed to. And there's always the possibility of genetic differences.
Well, and you're not actually saying that one kind of perceiving and reasoning is better than another, though.
Right, yeah. So we're just interested in the scientific question about human psychological variation.
So how controversial is your research now?
It really depends on the discipline you're talking about. I don't think mainstream anthropology is particularly interested in this, although in many ways it fits with things that anthropologists have said for years. Psychology has interested, but they're not sure what to do with it because there's such a set of institutions and constraints on psychologists that they're very much tied to this undergraduate subject pool that they mind. So it's really hard and expensive for psychologists to get out and tap these diverse subject pools. We get very few arguments that are an intellectual argument about why we're wrong. We get a lot of practical arguments about why what we're asking people to do is really hard. And economics, I think, of all the disciplines, is taking this on much more seriously. And because there's development economics that already has work going on in diverse societies as they try to understand the process of development, it's much easier for them to begin to conduct systematic empirical research that's also experimental in diverse societies. So I'd say the biggest strides have been made within economics.
Well, how can we apply this then?
Intuitively, a lot of policy is made assuming that people are kind of one size fits all. If you transport the institutions we use in Ohio to another country, then people, once they get the institutions around them, the laws or whatever, should just switch and start behaving in a different way. And what this suggests is that diverse populations are going to respond very differently to changes, and they come into it with very different psychological dispositions, and you can't have a one-size-fits-all development policy, for example.
Well, see, that's interesting because that's not surprising, and I wouldn't think that would be very controversial. But thinking about it a different way, it is a bit of a blow to our Western conception of human nature.
Right. And the biggest thing it is that means if you take a course in psychology, what they don't tell you is that the textbook is composed almost entirely of experiments with undergraduates. So it should make you worry about just how much you're really learning about human psychology versus how much you're learning about Western undergraduate psychology.
Joseph, thanks very much for being here.
Happy to be with you.
You can find Joseph Henrich and his work at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there, why not click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus to hear about upcoming shows, or to iTunes, where you can download past episodes, subscribe to the program, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.